From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, a look at the Hoffa victory to lead the Teamsters. We'll hear from Hurricane Carter about why he's in Texas with his keys to the city of Houston. And law professor Alan Dershowitz on perjury, police perjury, that is. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. House Judiciary Chair Henry Hyde said yesterday there's a compelling case for President Clinton's impeachment as the White House prepares for a decisive showdown before the committee. The White House readies a two-day defense to kick off the panel's climactic week of impeachment hearings, and Hyde told a news conference he had not decided whether to allow the panel to vote on censure as an alternative to impeachment. Hyde confirmed the panel was developing three articles of impeachment for perjury, obstruction of justice, and abuse of power stemming from the Monica Lewinsky affair, but said the exact wording would await the White House's presentation. Attorney General Janet Reno decided yesterday against an independent counsel to investigate President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore over political ads financed by the Democratic Party during the 1996 election. She said her announcement marked the end of the Justice Department's investigation into whether the so-called issue ads violate federal criminal law. At the heart of the allegations is whether Clinton and Gore tried to circumvent campaign spending limits through the $46 million in television advertising that was paid for by the Democratic Party, but designed to promote their reelection. Among other groups criticizing Attorney General Janet Reno's decision against an independent counsel to investigate the political ads of President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore was the group Common Cause. Meanwhile, reaching back to the Nixon impeachment drama a quarter century ago, President Clinton's lawyers will call Watergate veterans to testify that he should not be removed from office for the Monica Lewinsky affair. In up to 30 hours of testimony over 2 days before the House Judiciary Committee, top White House attorneys Charles Ruff and Gregory Craig will summon former members of Congress and lawyers who served during the investigations of President Richard Nixon's Watergate scandal, including ex-Congressmember Elizabeth Holtzman. She was a Democracy Now! Guest a few weeks ago. Scholars and ex-government officials also are among the 14 witnesses slated to testify before the committee. A top advisor to President Clinton said today Australia should consider an international plan to become a dumping ground for the world's nuclear waste, drawing immediate protests from environmentalists. Clinton's special envoy on weapons of mass destruction, Robert Gallucci, said Australia is in a unique position because of its geography and political stability to help the world solve the problem of where to store nuclear waste from bombs dismantled at the end of the Cold War. The Australian government has denied holding ministerial talks with the U.S. on a possible waste dump and has offered no public support for the plan, a move that would draw the immediate ire of environmentalists. But the Clinton advisor said the White House had been briefed on a U.S. company's proposal to establish a massive nuclear waste dump in remote parts of Australia's west and south, a plan he backed. A videotape issued by Seattle-based Pangea promoting the idea of a massive Australian dump was leaked to Australian environmentalists last week, forcing the company to go public with its plans. According to the company, only two countries in the world, Argentina and Australia, have the needed stable geography and political systems for a nuclear dump like the one it is proposing. This news from Jerusalem. A hunger strike by Palestinians in Israeli jails intensified today after more than 260 detainees joined a week-old protest against Israel's refusal to release security prisoners. This, according to Palestinian officials, an unrest sparked by Palestinian anger over the continued detention. Clashes erupted near Arab East Jerusalem between Israeli soldiers and stone-throwing Palestinian students. According to witnesses, the army responded by firing tear gas inside the school. Palestinian prisoners plan an overall strike on December 11th, the day before President Clinton begins a visit to Israel and the Palestinian occupied areas. And this news from Belgium, the European Union yesterday called for Kurdish rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan, under arrest in Rome, to be tried in an international court despite Turkey's demands for his extradition. EU foreign ministers issued a statement supporting Italy's decision not to extradite Öcalan, head of the outlawed Kurdish Workers' Party, or PKK, to Turkey, where he could face the death penalty. And from Johannesburg, Reuters Newswire is reporting that Angolan forces and the former rebel group UNITA are involved in heavy fighting, while government warplanes have raided UNITA strongholds. That's some of the news. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 41 years after his famous father was elected to the same post, James P. Hoffa this weekend won the presidency of the Teamsters. As he declared victory yesterday, the younger Hoffa vowed to unite a faction-split union, saying the Teamsters had been through a civil war. Hoffa also said there will be a new militancy in Teamsters negotiations that will build on a strategy launched by the union last summer against corporate America. One of the first challenges to Hoffa will be the fact that United Parcel Service, UPS, is not honoring the contract that was considered a victory for the union following last summer's strike. We're joined today by Stanley Aronowitz, a distinguished professor of sociology at the City University of New York, an author of more than a dozen books, including his most recent, From the Ashes of the Old, American Labor and America's Future. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Aronowitz.
Thank you very much.
So let's talk about the Teamsters and what you think the ascendancy of James P. Hoffa Jr. means.
Well, I think in the first place, it means, to a certain extent, the return of the old guard. Hoffa was connected to the group within the Teamsters of large local unions and district councils who were deeply concerned in the late 1980s and early 1990s when Ron Carey made his bid to reform the Teamsters from within. These were not the people who were for direct election for the president of the Teamsters Union. It took a court monitor to actually order such an election which he benefited from. But on the other hand, Hoffa faces a very divided union. Let it not be forgotten that Tom Leadham, with virtually no money, and a disgraced ally, Ron Carey, still managed to get 39% of the vote, and another candidate got 6% of the vote, which is 43% together, I guess. And although Hoffa won with a clear majority, he faces a series of very, very profound challenges. And the one that you mentioned is the one that he'll have to solve, and I think his whole presidency is going to rest on whether he solves it. And that is whether he will make the United Parcel Service live up to its agreement to hire 10,000 full-time workers, whether he will make UPS really go in the direction of eliminating or at least mitigating the two-tier wage system, which plagued the team since 1982. And there's a second problem. Today, in the New York Times and in the Wall Street Journal, reports that Hoffa was going to start a new wave of organizing. But he mentioned hospital workers, and he mentioned public employees, where the service employees and the state, county, municipal employees have been very strong. His first task, it seems to me, is not the public employees, although the Teamsters have a real presence among public employees, but to deal with the fact that since deregulation in the late 1970s, the Teamsters have lost over 1 million members, many of them in the transportation industry. He's going to have to start a campaign to organize the tens of thousands of truckers who have been released from union protections and are now in the position of being called lessees of trucks. These leasing agreements with big corporations are a way to get out of the union contract, a way not to pay health and welfare benefits, and a way to make the truckers themselves responsible. They're not really small business people. They're really employees and contract labor in a way that exists in many other industries. I think his statement is unfortunate because I think he should put the trucking industry on notice that he's going to organize in the trucking industry as well as other places. Having said that, I think the prospects are, at this point, uncertain as to where he'll go.
We're talking to Professor Stanley Aronowitz of the City University of New York. His latest book is called From the Ashes of the Old, American Labor and America's Future. I saw him interviewed this weekend on some of the talk shows on Sunday, and he made a point of saying, alluding to, but clearly saying, we're not just going to be Democrat, we're going to be working with both parties. What exactly does this mean? What does it say about the old guard, and what does it say about him?
Well, Amy, I think one of the major problems that the Hoffa dynasty, now the Hoffa dynasty, has always had with the Democratic Party, is that it was John Kennedy's brother, Bobby, who went after Hoffa. He was the head of the Senate Committee. He was the counsel for the Senate Committee at the time when Hoffa was brought to indictment. He was very much part of the political efforts of the Kennedys to win the presidency on the backs of the union that Hoffa led. Recall that the same year Hoffa was elected, the Senate conducted hearings under James McClellan of Arkansas. The McClellan hearings led to the Landrum-Griffin Act, or the Labor Management Reporting Act, which is provides for many of the safeguards on union corruption that we saw that led to the Carey victory. And from the Hoffa's point of view, the Democratic Party is an unreliable ally of labor and certainly an unreliable ally of the Teamsters. And they faulted Ron Carey for joining John Sweeney and the rest of the coalition that elected Sweeney in becoming really partners in the Democratic Party. What it means is that if he's serious, that he wants to pull out of that alliance and go back to the old, at least, ideology of independence of the unions from both political parties, is that we're going to go back to a period which only hasn't existed in a long time, where the unions choose their Republicans, choose their Democrats to endorse, and pretty much stay aloof of the political party system. If this meant eventually that they would not give the kind of money they give to the Democratic Party, $35 million in 1996, $35 million, that's a lot of money, it means the Democrats would be deprived of money, but they also would be deprived of volunteers for national elections and perhaps for congressional elections as well. Having said that, I think one of the major problems is whether Hoffa is going to get away with it, whether he's actually going to be able to pull the Teamsters out of the Democratic Party alliance. Certainly there will be a period of very hot negotiations between Hoffa and John Sweeney on the question of the Teamsters' participation. He said today in the paper that he wants to raise a lot of money for political action, and he wants to support pro-labor Republicans. And I wonder, what pro-labor Republicans does he have in mind? I could make very few arguments for Republicans in the Senate or the House who would be consistently pro-labor. In fact, Hoekstra, a Republican, is holding hearings even as we speak to try to develop new legislation to throttle labor. So I'm pretty much concerned. I would be concerned if I were an AFL-CIO activist that Hoffa's cry for independence means anything more than I don't like the Democratic Party, and I think I'm going to stay aloof. I don't think he has a positive program.
Now, we're talking about different groups of people, different unions here, but this recently announced or proposed merger of Exxon and Mobil, how does that bear on union politics, but even on the Teamsters? And does it?
Well, the Teamsters represent the Exxon workers in New Jersey. I don't know whether most people know the Teamsters have that. I was a representative for the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union before I retired into the academy. And we held an election in Exxon, which is near Elizabeth and Linden, New Jersey. And the Teamsters beat the Oil, Chemical workers. In fact, there was never really any kind of contest. So they have a direct interest as a union in this merger, as does the oil, chemical, and atomic workers. It seems to me that the ExxonMobil merger is simply a symptom of a development in American business, transnational business, actually, in which industries and companies are merging fast and reestablishing monopolies, more technically oligopolies, in various industries. Unions that were able to negotiate with these companies are going to be forced to work together to negotiate with those companies. One of the great scandals of the American labor movement has been the relative lack of cooperation between unions doing contracts with the same company. In fact, it's almost as bad as internationally they don't work together either. But within the United States, these two unions have different kinds of agreements, and the oil chemical represents most oil refining workers. Teamsters only a few refineries. But it's going to mean he's going to have to extend the hand, and the traditional posture of the Teamsters as a kind of autarkic organization is going to break down.
Autarkic?
Autarkic. That means self-generating, autonomous, but autonomous to the extent that they really don't look outward. They look mostly inward.
How does John Sweeney, the head of the AFL-CIO, feel about the Hafa ascendancy?
I think he's chagrined. He's going to have to deal with Hafa. Don't misunderstand me. But he was more or less openly in support of Ron Kerry, both in the 1991 and the 1996 election. Sweeney saw Kerry as a close ally. And in fact, let's put it as bluntly as we can, had it not been for Kerry's election in 1991, the Sweeney ascendancy of 1995 would have been impossible. Sweeney needed the Teamsters' 1.3 or 1.4 million votes to win that election. And without it, he would have lost the election and we would have not been sitting here today.
We're talking to Stanley Aronowitz, a former labor organizer, now a distinguished professor of sociology at the City University of New York. His book, Ashes of the Old, American Labor and America's Future. In the news headlines, I just read about Attorney General Janet Reno's decision not to investigate Clinton and Gore and their fundraising activities, which is very much connected also to union organizing. And we also know that Attorney General Janet Reno is deciding whether or not to hire an independent investigator around the issue of Harold Ickes and his relationship to the Teamsters. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes. Well, let's start with the Ickes, because the Ickes issue is probably why Hafa is president today in a most direct sense. Ron Kerry won the 1991 election against two other candidates of the old guard who ended up supporting Hafa because he promised, among other things, not only to be militant at the bargaining table, but also to bring union democracy to the membership of that union. He also said that he would not take any money from anybody but members of the union. He would not seek outside funds. He would raise all of his money from the rank and file supporters that he had garnered in the previous couple of years. That was a very seductive plea to a group of Teamsters who felt that they had been to a large extent sold out by the mob, sold out by high-level bureaucrats of the union, oligarchs, really. And so what happened in 1996 when Jimmy Hafa replaced this group that had challenged Kerry in 1991 is that Hafa came in like gangbusters. He had a lot of money. And they knew that he was going to be able to run a very credible, very powerful campaign, not only because of the name of his father, but because he could go around with plenty of money to both give out and to use as publicity. Kerry then took the opportunity to raise money, not only from the rank and file. He didn't think he could raise $1 million. And I'm not sure he was wrong. But what he did is he went to libs. Liberal organizations, public citizen, not public citizens, Citizens Action. Public Citizen never would do such a
thing. Very different.
Excuse me, Ralph Nader. Citizens Action. And he went to other groups and he went to the White House and got collaboration to launder money from the Teamsters Treasury. Now, I have some friends in the press who say, Stanley, that never happened. Nobody's ever proven that. I think the evidence of the three henchmen of Kerry going pretty much to the White House as well as to these liberal organizations to launder dues money is pretty heavy. Whether it's heavy or not, whether it's true or not, Ickes would have to have been involved in the election of Ron Carey. And so Ickes is up for that kind of interference.
Professor Aronowitz, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I want to ask you a last question. It has to do with impeachment, and it has to do with limiting the inquiry not to campaign fundraising. And then we're going to look at what's happening in Texas this week in the next 8 days. Five men scheduled to die. Actually, it's four now because one was killed last night. And we're going to find out why Reuben Hurricane Carter is in Texas with his keys to the city of Houston. Then we're going to hear from Alan Dershowitz, law professor at Harvard University, and what he has to say about perjury, police perjury, that is. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now. We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we wrap up with Professor Stanley Aronowitz, former union organizer. His new book is From the Ashes of the Old, American Labor and America's Future. I wanted to ask you today, 30 days of defense of President Clinton today and tomorrow. The House Judiciary Committee will hear that defense and then vote on articles of impeachment, decide whether to impeach the president. I wanted to get your views on that and also in the context of what we've been talking about.
Well, it would be very nice if the president of the United States could say he has a different sexual lifestyle than is expected by anybody who runs for president of the United States. He does. He's a figure who has done what most other presidents do. But the problem is we don't have the political environment to allow him to come clean. However, it is outrageous that this should be considered an impeachable defense. The problem, however, with Clinton, and it's the problem for the labor movement, is that Clinton has been so vulnerable on so many issues, and the labor movement has been so tied to Clinton's persona, his presidency, that the union movement, when such scandals take place, has been entirely quiet about issues of such as impeachment. They should be out there saying that impeachment is a scandal, that impeachment is an outrage. But here's our problem. Our problem is that the labor movement is for family values, and family values is what Clinton has adopted, and family values is a right-wing issue. And so the labor movement is on the right on the family issues, and so it cannot say a word, and it feels itself in a bind. If Clinton goes down, however, the labor movement is going to have to think second time about whether Hoffa's pulling out of the Democratic Party is not their best bet. I actually think that's the best thing that Hoffa might do for the labor movement, is to get them out of the embrace of the Clintons and the Democrats and so on.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Stanley Aronowitz, for joining us. He is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York. His latest book, From the Ashes of the Old, American Labor and America's Future.
The greatest middleweight champions of the world, Reuben Hurricane Carter.
Yes, that song, well-known Bob Dylan song about Reuben Hurricane Carter. And we're going to find out today why Hurricane Carter is in Texas. Texas has scheduled 4 executions in a row for this Human Rights Week. Last night, killed Daniel Lee Corwin, condemned under the state's serial killer statute for killing 3 women. Corwin blamed his crime on, quote, uncontrollable pressures in my head, and read a lengthy statement before his death in which he apologized to his victims' family members. We now turn to a story that's been attracting increasing international and national attention, the case of Joseph Stanley Falder, 61-year-old Canadian citizen scheduled to be executed in Texas on December 10th. That's the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Falder was sentenced to death for the 1975 murder of Inez Phillips, the 75-year-old widow of the former mayor of Gladewater, and the matriarch of a wealthy and influential Texas oil family. Last week, during my visit to Houston and to Huntsville, where death row is located, I interviewed Falder's attorney, Sandra Babcock, who told Democracy Now! That as a Canadian citizen, Falder was not notified by Texas authorities of his right to contact the Canadian consulate for help when he was arrested for murder, a right guaranteed under the Vienna Convention for Consular Rights. Since then, a delegation from Canada, led by former boxing champ Reuben Hurricane Carter, has landed in Texas to pressure Texas authorities to grant clemency to Falder, who's been on death row for more than 2 decades. People who've also intervened on behalf of Falder include Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. She wrote to Texas Governor George Bush and to the Board of Pardons and Paroles asking for a delay in the execution. As well, Canadian Foreign Affairs Minister Lloyd Axworthy, and most recently, South African Bishop Desmond Tutu. He, in a letter to Bush, said, "Please spare the life of Joseph Stanley Falder, at least as a humanitarian act." Tutu said he felt compelled to act after ordinary Canadians called him at his hotel room during a recent visit to Canada, asking him to intervene on behalf of Falder. Today, we're joined by Reuben Hurricane Carter, whose promising boxing career was cut short when he was imprisoned for 19 years for murders he did not commit, and who heads the Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted. When he was released from prison, Carter was given the key to Houston. He's now back in the city to redeem it. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Hurricane. Very good. So you've brought your keys back to Houston. And what are you doing with them? We're also joined, Hurricane, by Mark Warren, who is the USA coordinator of the Canadian section of Amnesty International. He's assisted the defense of Stanley Falder for the last 6 years. As well, he's been documenting cases of foreign citizens sentenced to death in the United States and has authored several amnesty reports on foreign nationals on death row. Mark Warren, we did have Sandra Babcock on, as we said last week, who laid out Falder's case. Can you talk about, just very briefly, why it's so important? I mean, for people who hear about these murders of these 3 women, for people who hear about the murder of the wife of the mayor of Gladewater, they might think it's a little technical to say, well, the Canadian consulate wasn't advised that he was in prison. What's your response to that?
I can understand that position, but this is clearly not a technicality. Amnesty International has documented compelling evidence that if the Canadian consulate had been notified and involved, as they should have been under international law, that it might well have altered the entire course and outcome of this trial. Indeed, that's why the U.S. Secretary of State intervened by sending lengthy letters to the Texas authorities last week. She was careful to point out in her letters that this case is distinguishable from many others in which the violation of the treaty is an issue, in that there is very persuasive material to suggest that timely intervention by the Canadian consulate could have altered the outcome of a death penalty case.
What is the response of people in Canada right now, Mark Warren? Is this case well known? Is it just known among you, the anti-death penalty activists?
Well, I was told yesterday that there were approximately 35 newspaper articles on the Falder case published over the weekend in Canada alone. So it's certainly a case which has received extremely broad attention and concern. You know, Canadians travel to the United States in enormous numbers every year, and I think we have a very legitimate interest and concern when one of our own citizens is kept on death row for 15 years and our own government isn't even aware of their circumstances, let alone permitted to assist, as indeed they should have been.
Mark Warren and Reuben Hurricane Carter were also joined at station KPFT, Pacifica's Houston station, by David Atwood. I got a chance to meet him last week when a group of activists gathered to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. David Atwood is executive director of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. What understanding do people in Texas have of what is going on right now with the Falder case? We see that someone is about to be executed tonight, tomorrow night, but the Falder case on Thursday is clearly the one that's getting the most attention.
Well, I do think that it has got some publicity in the newspapers. It's been in the paper in Houston and the Austin American Statesman. However, this is Texas, and we have a lot of executions here. And it doesn't get the attention certainly here that it gets in Canada, unfortunately. I think it should.
Look at the case, and you look at all the problems with the trial, and it was a sham process as far as I'm concerned. And I hope that this case will get more attention. We're certainly trying to do that. I'm working with Hurricane Carter to try to get the publicity. And we hope that this case will get the attention of the Texas people, but it's hard to get the attention down here because we do have so many executions.
We're talking to David Atwood, executive director of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, Mark Warren, who is in Toronto, Ontario, and he is with the Canadian section of Amnesty International, and Reuben Hurricane Carter. Reuben, what has been the response to you returning to Texas? You were there, more than 20 years ago for a big benefit conference concert when you came out of prison.
That's true. I wasn't here. I was in prison at the time. I was sentenced. Oh, by the way, hi, Mark. How you doing?
Hi, Reuben. Good to hear from you.
It's good to hear from you, brother. I was in prison at the time, and I was trying to get a new trial because my trial, I was convicted wrongly. I was accused of murdering three people in a New Jersey bar. There was no evidence. There was just two convicted stool pigeons, two felons, who were paid $10,000 reward for their perjured testimony. I was convicted by two separate grand juries, just like Joseph Falder was convicted by two separate grand juries. And as I said, I had two federal felon convicts testify at my trial, just like Joseph Falder had two snitches who were paid a lot of money in order to give perjured testimony. And when I couldn't find the help that I needed in the state of New Jersey, it was at that time that Bob Dylan, Joni Baez, Joni Mitchell, and Isaac Hayes and Stevie Wonder came down here to Houston, to the Astrodome, and put on a concert for me entitled The Night of the Hurricane. And my wife and daughter came with them. And the mayor of Houston at that time, in solidarity with everything that was going on, presented my wife and daughter with the key to the city, and then took the flag down and gave it to my wife to bring back to me in prison. Now, I think that was a great thing. I think that was a heartwarming opening for Texans to do that when the people in the state of New Jersey wouldn't do that. So I am here today, we are here today, to ask the people, to ask Texans, because we know that Texans are intelligent. We know that they're honest. We know that they're strong. We didn't come here to fight. We came to negotiate. We put on the governor's table a proposition. We said if you stop this execution, AIDWIC, the Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted, will send our investigators down here to Texas, and we will find out what the truth is. What we don't want is for the Texas people to make a horrible, horrible mistake by killing the wrong person. We want to make sure you got the right person, and we don't think that Stanley Fowler is the right person, based on all of the irregularities that have taken on in his case. That's the reason why we're here.
David Atwood, you're with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Tell us where this case is right now. You have Governor George Bush, the son of the former president, avid supporter of the death penalty. He says he's waiting a word from the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles before he makes a decision on granting Fowler a 30-day stay of execution, and says that people can't just come into our state and cold-blood murder somebody. Can you tell us where this stands? Because there is this interesting aspect of the case, which is the fact that the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles has never or only once had an open public meeting, when apparently in the state Texas Constitution it says that they have to.
Right. In fact, there was an announcement yesterday by, I believe it was the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, that the state was going to have to the parole board was going to have open meetings. I understand there has to be another ruling on that before it's completely blessed, but that's the key at this point, is that the Board of Pardons and Paroles, and that's what a lot of people have been requesting, is that they do have an open meeting. They have to come together. They have to hear testimony. At the current time, it's done all secretly. The members of the Board of Pardons and Paroles are spread throughout the state of Texas in different places. They vote in secret. They do it by fax. And then the chairman of the Board of Pardons and Paroles, Victor Rodriguez, gives the decision to the governor. The way I look at this is there's a lack of accountability in what's going on. And you're not going to have accountability unless you have an open record, an open session, and it's not fair. It's not fair to the individuals whose lives are at stake here. So I think that this, I hope, we're all hoping that this will change and that this will be addressed properly by the courts. And that's going to be very important for Stanley Fowler and a number of other people. It's an example of and Mark knows this, there was an Amnesty International report on Texas last year, and it pointed out all the deficiencies in the legal system in this state, and they were numerous, one after another. I don't see how the state can continue to carry on this process and have any credibility, not only in Texas, but in the United States and throughout the world.
Mark Warren, where does this case stand right now, the case of Joseph Stanley Fowler, slated to die on Thursday night, Texas time, at 6 o'clock?
Mr. Fowler's attorney has filed a petition with the United States Supreme Court for judicial review, and we're anticipating that the court will issue its decision possibly within the next day. There is also, as Dave mentioned, an appeal lodged by the state, which is pending before the Texas Supreme Court. That appeal is an attempt to overturn a restraining order that was issued against the Board of Pardons, requiring them to hold public meetings. Once again, we're expecting a decision on that today. And I've just recently learned that Mr. Fowler's attorney will be filing a new habeas corpus petition, arguing that the clemency process in Texas is so arbitrary and capricious that it violates the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So essentially, I think we're going to be looking at a flurry of last-minute legal maneuvers and litigation, and it looks very much as though this case is going to go down to the wire.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. And when we come back, we're also going to hear about another case. A man, a former child refugee from Vietnam, scheduled to die a minute past midnight on December 10th. And we're going to find out what his mental state is right now. You are listening to Democracy Now! Our guest, Hurricane Carter, who's just come to Houston to challenge the execution of Stanley Falder on Thursday. We're also talking to Mark Warren in Ontario. He is the USA coordinator for Amnesty International, and David Atwood, executive director of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. As well, when we come back, we're going to get the number of that Texas Coalition if people want to get in touch with the coalition in Texas, where more people are executed than in any state in this country. In fact, Texas is the death penalty capital of the Western world. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests are in Canada and in Texas. As we talk about death row on Texas, where in the next week, four more men are expected to be executed, the latest last night killed in Texas. We are talking to Reuben Hurricane Carter, yes, the well-known boxing champion, might have been the boxing champion of the world if he hadn't been incarcerated for about two decades for murders he did not commit. He was eventually exonerated and now leads an organization in Canada called the Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted. We're also talking to Mark Warren, who's in Ontario, and he is the USA coordinator for the Canadian section of Amnesty International. David Atwood is in the Houston studio, executive director of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Before we get a quick update from Mark Warren on another case that is happening this week in Oklahoma, I wanted to get last comments from Reuben Hurricane Carter and Mark Warren on this case. Hurricane Carter, you were a few weeks ago in Chicago for the Northwestern University Conference on Innocence and the Death Penalty, where dozens of people gathered who had been released from prison, wrongly convicted, had been on death row. It sounds like it was a remarkable event, and we played your speech on Democracy Now! So what are your thoughts as you sit in the state where there are more executions than in any state in this country, in any country in the Western world?
Well, I tell you, it is really frightening. What's going on in Texas? The killing machine is running rampant. It is going wild, and we must put an end to that. I mean, the death penalty does not belong in any civilized society. I mean, that's just not acceptable to civilized, right-thinking human beings. And that people are being killed on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Universal Human Rights is almost like a slap in the face to all people in the country. People should really understand what it is to take someone's life, whether you take it by state-sanctioned murder or whether you do it as a criminal. It's still the same thing. Someone is being deprived of the most precious commodity, the most precious gift they have on this earth, and that's life. And I think that people need to do something about it, and we need to do it quickly. You know, Texas is... Texans are bidding for the 2012 Olympics. Well, if you keep executing people as regularly as you're executing people, there will be nobody left in Texas to participate in the Olympics. I mean, somebody has to take a stand with this. And like with Gary Graham on death row again, subject to be executed. I mean, somebody's got to say, whoa, let's take a look at what we're doing. And I hope that I can be some influence into looking in that direction.
Hurricane Carter, can you give us the phone number of the Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted in Canada?
Yes, the phone number is area code 416-531-8019. I'll say that again. Area code 416-531-8019.
And David Atwood, your last comment and phone number of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
Well, we really appreciate Hurricane Carter coming down here with the delegation. And they're not only doing beautiful, wonderful work for Stanley Falder, they're promoting the whole abolition movement, which we need everybody throughout the world to join together on this whole effort. And so we appreciate so much their coming here to Texas. Our telephone number is area code 713-529-8326.
That's 713-529-8326. We only have
I'm sorry, 529-3826.
That's 713-529-3826. And finally, Mark Warren,
right,
in Canada. We only have a minute, but we do want to hear about this Oklahoma case, Tuen Nguyen, the former child refugee from Vietnam, who's scheduled to die a minute past midnight on December 10th.
Well, once again, this is a truly extraordinary case. There's every indication that the incarceration in the hellhole of Oklahoma's H unit, death row, has driven this man insane. In fact, it's quite clear that he has no concept of where he is or why he's being punished, and that's a gross and flagrant violation of international law. And to execute an individual under those circumstances on December 10th is simply adding insult to injury.
Mark Warren, we want to thank you very much, and we will continue to cover these executions throughout the week and the rest of the year. We will continue to make executions headline news. Whatever you feel about the death penalty, we do feel it's important that you know when the state is executing someone somewhere in this country. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! President Clinton's lawyers today have begun presenting the president's case against impeachment before the House Judiciary Committee. At the end of their two-day, 30-hour defense, they'll have presented 14 witnesses testifying on why the president should not be impeached. In last week's hearings, the panel heard from legal experts discussing perjury. And although convicted perjurers who testified got the national spotlight, the words of Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz on police perjury went almost unnoticed. This is what he had to say.
For nearly a quarter of a century, I have been teaching, lecturing, and writing about the corrosive influences of perjury on our legal system, especially when committed by those whose job it is to enforce the law, and ignored or even legitimated by those whose responsibility it is to check those who enforce the law. I appreciate very much your asking me to share my experience and expertise here with you today. My own interest in the corrosive influences of perjury arose from two cases that I appeared in as a young lawyer. In both cases, the policemen were caught committing perjury, one on tape and the other by his own admission. In both cases, the policemen were promoted, not prosecuted. Neither of those policemen were called to appear as witnesses here today. All reports on the persuasive, pervasive problems of police perjury and tolerance of the lying by prosecutors and judges point to a widespread problem. The Mollen Commission in New York, for example, concluded that the practice of police falsification is so common that it has spawned its own word, test-a-lying. Officers who commit falsification to charge, serve what they perceive to be legitimate law enforcement ends are committing perjury. The commission provided several examples of perjured cover stories that had been suggested to young officers in order to make arrests. Many judges who listen to or review police testimony on a regular basis agree with Judge Alex Kaczynski of the Ninth Circuit, who said it's an open secret long shared by prosecutors, defense lawyers, and judges that perjury is widespread among law enforcement officials. Yet there is little apparent concern to remedy that serious abuse of the oath to tell the truth. Even among those who now claim to be so concerned with the corrosive influences of perjury on our legal system. This committee, for example, in pursuance of his oversight mandate, has never, to my knowledge, conducted hearings on this deeply corrosive issue, which has far more dangerous impact over our legal system than anything charged against President Clinton. If this were truly today an objective hearing on the consequences of perjury or on double standards, it would focus on the most serious types of perjury, that committed by police with the approval of prosecutors and judges. Yet, we see no such concern. A perfect example of the selective morality regarding perjury occurred when President George Bush pardoned the former Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, in 1992, even though the evidence was absolutely clear and convincing. The real issue is not the couple of convicted perjurers who appeared before this committee today or the judges who condemn the evils of perjury, but the hundreds of thousands of perjurers who are never prosecuted and who this committee does not seem to care about, many for extremely serious and calculated lies designed to undercut constitutional rights of unpopular defendants, and the judges who say nothing and do nothing about this corrosive phenomenon. You could not fit into this room or into this building all of the people who testified more perjuriously than President Clinton and were not ever prosecuted. If we really want to reduce the corrosive effect of perjury on our legal system, the place to begin is at or near the top of the perjury hierarchy. If instead we continue deliberately to blind ourselves to pervasive police perjury and other equally dangerous forms of lying under oath, and focus on a politically charged tangential lie in the lowest category of possible perjury, hiding embarrassing facts by evasive answers to poorly framed questions which were marginally relevant to a dismissed civil case, we will be reaffirming the dangerous and hypocritical message that perjury will continue to be selectively prosecuted as a crime reserved for political or other agenda-driven purposes. On the basis of my academic and professional experience, I believe that no felony is committed more frequently in this country than the genre of perjury and false statement crimes. Perjury during civil depositions and trials is so endemic that a respected appellate judge once observed that, quote, experienced lawyers say that in large cities, scarcely a trial occurs in which some witness does not lie. Police perjury in criminal cases, particularly in the context of searches and other exclusionary rule issues, is so pervasive that the former police chief of San Jose and Kansas City has estimated that hundreds of thousands of law enforcement officials commit felony perjury every year, testifying about drug arrests alone. But in comparison with their frequency, perjury crimes are among the most underprosecuted in this country. As prosecutor Michael McCann concluded, outside of income tax violation, perjury is probably the most underreported crime in America. Moreover, there is evidence that false statements are among the most selectively prosecuted of all crimes, and that the criteria for selectivity bears little relationship to the willfulness or frequency of the lies, the certainty of the evidence, or any other neutral criteria relating to the elements of perjury. Historically, I think we can all agree that false statements have admitted of considerable variation in degree. The core concept of perjury grows out of the Bible, the Ten Commandments. Bearing false witness, a term that consisted in accusing another falsely of a crime. Clearly the most heinous brand of lying is the giving of false testimony that results in the imprisonment of somebody who is innocent. Less egregious but still quite serious is false testimony that results in the conviction of a person who may be guilty, but whose rights were violated in a manner that would preclude conviction if the police testified truthfully. There are many other points of this continuum, ranging from making false statements about income taxes to testifying falsely in civil trials. The least culpable genre of false testimony are those that deny embarrassing personal conduct of marginal relevance to the matter at issue in the legal proceeding. I think it is clear that the false statements of which President Clinton is accused fall at the most marginal end of the least culpable genre of this continuum of offenses and would never even be considered for prosecution in the routine cases involving an ordinary defendant. A Republican aide to this committee was quoted in the New York Times as follows. In the hearing, we'd be looking to whether it's tenable for a nation to have two different standards for lying under oath, one for the president and one for everyone else. On the basis of my research and experience, I am convinced that if President Clinton were an ordinary citizen, he would not be prosecuted for his allegedly false statements. If President Clinton were ever to be prosecuted or impeached for perjury on the basis of the currently available evidence, it would indeed represent an improper double standard, a selectively harsher one for this president and perhaps a handful of other victims of selective prosecution, and the usual laxer one for everyone else, especially popular police perjurers. Thank you. All they care about.
You're listening to Alan Dershowitz as he continues now in a discussion with Henry Hyde, the head of the House Judiciary Committee.
You don't believe it's perjury? Not perjury by police officers, not perjury that affect the lives of Americans on a daily basis, but only perjury committed by one Democratic president. Nothing can trivialize the rule of law more than to selectively isolate this case and act as if it is the only case of perjury that's important. And, Mr. Chairman, you contributed to that in the beginning when you said that this was going to be a broad hearing about the pervasive influence of perjury on the American system. That is Hamlet without the prince. To talk about the pervasive influence of perjury on the American legal system and ignore 100 years of police perjury and documented reports about police perjury and pretend and close your eyes and make believe that the only perjury worth considering is perjury about a sex lie committed by a president to the opposite party trivializes the rule of law and trivializes the oath of office.
I thank you, Professor Dershowitz. I don't thank you for criticizing the motives, saying that we're out to get the president. You haven't the slightest idea of the agony that many of us go through over this question. Many of us are sensitive to those concerns. All of us, I dare say. I think you have disparaged us by leaping to conclusions without any basis. Well, but I will just a minute. Now, I will tell you something. These two women who came here today are suffering permanent damage because they lied under oath about matters that are relatively trivial. And we are concerned about the double standard. That may mean nothing to you.
Means a great deal to me.
But it means something to us.
Mr. Chairman. Means a great deal to me. You selected these two women. I mean, when is the last time this committee has expressed concern about the rights of criminal defendants?
You are listening to an interaction between Alan Dershowitz and House Judiciary Committee Chair Henry Hyde, as today President Clinton is defended by his lawyers. That was testimony the Harvard Law professor gave last week on perjury, particularly perjury of the police. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion and Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director today is Michael G. Haskins. Thanks to Bob Sham at KPFT. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!